fear. And to be clear, I'm not talking about the nameable diagnosis of anxiety. So this is not an exploration of something clinical. It's an exploration of something that's wider in the culture. It's not a series in the sense that each week's consideration can stand on its own, but the week by week, as I'm thinking about this, I am connecting the bits to one another. There is a sequence of ideas here that I'm exploring, and so if the topic feels significant in your experience, then it's probably worth checking out the podcasts to kind of get some sense of sequence. And especially, I'm mentioning that this morning because especially this week, this is going to be a little heady. So forewarned, forearmed, more overtly philosophical than usual. And mostly what I'm going to do is raise questions. We'll dig into some of that in the coming gatherings. But if you hit the end of the talky bit this morning and it's kind of like, well, that just sort of stopped. It didn't feel like it had an arc. That's why. I grew up in a world that was a blender of several mythologies. But in my world, two of those prevailed. And before I get into that, a moment for the term mythology and how I'm going to be using it. There's an entire section on mythology just over there, by the way, in the bookstore. So if you want to, you know, continue your exploration of what's running in the background of that term, you can do it over there. But these days, the term myth is often taken to mean something that is untrue. And the folks that don't tend to use the word myth that way kind of fall broadly into a couple of camps. On the one hand, people who don't think that myth equals something that's untrue tend to be people who've thought about the power of myth for themselves. They've just had reasons to explore it, and so they have, and they've spent the time to kind of think about the nature of mythology and what it is and how it works in the world. Go, sweetie. The other group of people that doesn't tend to think about mythology as equaling something that's untrue are people who have literature degrees. Or who paid attention in their, you know, their lit class. Because properly taken, the term myth is a literary term. It's a story. A myth is a story that is told over and over to successive generations to explain why things are the way they are. So it's not hard to imagine that myths, under that definition, are extremely influential. Now, it could be really tempting to say that myths have been extremely influential and kind of relegate this whole category, to be dismissive about it and relegate them to the discard bin of fairy tales and superstitions. But I think that'd be pretty short-sighted, at least by the definition that I'm choosing to use. Historian Karen Armstrong says myths are, quote, universal and timeless stories that reflect and shape our lives. Timeless and universal stories that reflect and shape our lives. And myths are effective in doing that, reflecting and shaping our lives, because they're stories that explore the things that we experience. They explore things like our desires, our longings, our fears, and they provide narratives that remind us of what it means to be human. It's a big deal. So under that definition, what I want you to do, and this, your responses, should there be any, will not be on the podcast. If you're a podcast person, then this would be a moment to do this exercise for yourself. But under that definition, universal and timeless stories that reflect and shape our lives, stories that explore our desires, our fears, our longings, and provide narratives that help us understand what it means to be human, I want you to take a moment and think about some of the myths that are familiar and powerful in your life. So stories in your life that explore and explain, that reflect and shape both who you are and how the world around you works. The examples that I'm going to use touch on that. So if I think about these two mythologies that I wanted to dig into a little bit this morning, What I would say before I get into them is just to remind us that myths are the most powerful to those of us who grow up steeped in them, right? There's nothing quite as powerful as a myth that has become invisible to us. And so that's why it can be so challenging to us when we realize that other cultures and subcultures have different stories that explain or address the same meaning questions as the myths that we grew up with. The ones that we grew up with just start to feel true to us in the literal historic sense of that word. And the ones that are new to us usually feel, at least initially, fanciful or difficult to understand or just foreign and odd. You know, like, what the, right? They kind of have that cast to them. The two mythologies that I grew up soaking in are probably familiar to most of us, at least in some form. The first myth that I grew up close to was the myth of the origins of human morality. So to really shorten that myth, that's a story that says that we're all born morally broken. That's a powerful idea. Provides tremendously effective shorthand for answering whole sets of questions about human behavior and suffering and evil. For some folks, this is the myth that explains mosquitoes. You know, pick a suffering, right? And this one can have at it. In Christian theology, this story often gets called the doctrine of the fall or original sin. So you might be familiar with it under that particular guise. As an idea that has been passed along from generation to generation as a way of both understanding and shaping our lives, this is a myth that has all sorts of clout. Brené Brown, that most insightful of authors about shame, probably wouldn't have a career were it not for this particular mythology. There are some really serious questions to be explored regarding the origins of this mythology, not the least of which is that it doesn't appear in the original Hebrew story, and it's entirely alien to Jewish thought, which insists that sin can always only ever be a choice. To this day, that remains the case with Jewish thought. We can get into that another time, but for now, what I'm going to stick to is the fact that I grew up inside the conventional version of that myth, and it deeply informed my understanding of the world both around and within me. Had lots of impact. I'll come back to that. The second mythology that I grew up inside of is harder to summarize. For the purposes of our exploration this morning, I'm going to call it the mythology of modernity. So some of you already know we're in deep water, depending on what sort of terminology you've bumped into along the way. There are countless ways that we could try to define modernity's big ideas, but today what I want to do is I want to just touch on those big ideas, and then I want to look at them, because we're talking about fear, and we are getting there. I want to look at them, those big ideas really briefly through that lens, through the lens of fear. So modernity, as a way of understanding, explaining, and operating the world, emerged from post-medieval Europe. It's something that we still are very much under the influence of, despite, as a culture, despite being aware that some key parts of it are dying or dead or in active transition, it depends on your vantage point. I don't want to get bogged down here, but this is a really important set of ideas, and it has a mythic shape that impacts all of us in the Western world. And so I do want to spend a little bit of time here. Foucault suggested this definition of historical modernity, because again, there's lots of ways we could think about this. So this is his definition of historical modernity. Listen for cultural features that are so familiar that we don't think about them. Modernity refers to a period marked by a questioning or rejection of tradition, the prioritization of individualism, freedom, and formal equality, faith in inevitable social, scientific, and technological progress and human perfectibility, rationalization and professionalization, a movement from feudalism or agrarianism towards capitalism and the market economy, industrialization, urbanization, and secularization, the development of the nation state and its constituent institutions, for example, representative democracy or public education or modern bureaucracy, and forms of surveillance. So that's Foucault's shot at a definition of modernity offered in the mid-1990s. If some of those terms feel like they represent either familiar or even cherished ideas, that's because modernity has formed the background, kind of the backbone of the guiding mythology or story of how things work for our culture for about the last 500 years, which is long enough for it to get so embedded as to become invisible, or for lots of people to simply become true, to simply become the way we think the world works. Because that's what myths do when you soak in them. All right, so now, as some of you may be able to imagine, or some of you might have already experienced in your own life for yourself, there's a pretty obvious tension between those two storylines, those two mythological storylines that I just laid out, right? So in the first storyline, the one about the origins of human morality, It doesn't matter how hard you try, you can never ultimately get to the moral place you need to be because you're fundamentally broken. It doesn't matter how much good you do, you will not get to that necessary place. You were born that way, you're going to die that way, and by the way, the only reason God doesn't kill you outright for being that way is because he killed his own undeserving kid as an act of love. That's complicated. To pay for your get-out-of-jail-free card. All right? So that's basically the shape of that story. Of this, conventional Christianity says, you can be certain. Also an important idea. In the second myth, the myth of modernity, progress, including moral progress, in the form of social goodness and human perfectibility, is not only possible, but it's inevitable. In other words, you couldn't stop us humans from becoming better and better if you tried. That's what inevitable means. So, about seeing this through the lens of fear. Modernity was supposed to be the period in human history when the fears that pervaded social life in the past could be left behind and human beings could at last take control of their lives. We could tame the uncontrolled forces of the social and natural worlds. That's the myth of modernity. That's the way the world works under that storyline. It was a period of, we got this, people. We got this. And hubris, you know, kind of was the order of the day. Here's a worst-case modern scenario for you. We don't got this, so we have to go colonize the moon. We win. Right? So that's modernity in crisis. We're just going to leave. We'll take our technology and our potential somewhere else. We got this. Well, let's cut to the chase. Aside from a few science fiction-ish movies, not the least of which in fandom parts of our house is Joss Whedon's great space western Firefly, that hasn't worked out too well. And that is not to say that there hasn't been tremendous movement on many of those potentially good developments within modernity. There has been. I talked last week about just a couple of the rather encouraging ways of measuring some of those in terms of living longer, hurting less, making more, so on and so forth. But here we are, early in the 21st century, and we're not only not making inevitable progress toward utopia, but we have made such a thorough mess of the endeavor that we are awash in fear. We're afraid of natural disasters, we're afraid of environmental catastrophes, we're afraid of indiscriminate terrorist attacks, we feel like we don't have control over ourselves and our destiny, we feel like the social fabric of the world is unraveling, and we feel like danger could strike unannounced and at any moment. So, right? I said last week that we were going to spend a little bit of time exploring the thinking of this Polish sociologist and philosopher Zygmunt Bauman on this. Bauman is the thinker and author that called what I have been describing liquid fear. He called it fear because that's the word we tend to use to define our emotional response to an environment like that. And he called it liquid because, in his words, quote, there are no solid structures around us on which we can rely, in which we can invest our hopes and expectations. He used the word precariat from a French word almost exactly the same shape. The definition of the French word means to walk on shifting sand. So he called this generation the precariat. That's us. Liquid fear, Bauman says, is, quote, this is a really interesting definition, a tangible feeling of anxiety that has only vague contours, but is still acutely present everywhere. Liquid fear is a tangible feeling of anxiety that has only vague contours, but is still acutely present everywhere. His favorite metaphor for this is the experience of walking in a minefield. We know the field is full of explosives, but we don't know where or when the explosion will come. As I was writing this, I couldn't help but think about Ariel a week or two ago in our community time, talking about the profound dilemma of someone who, as she shared publicly, so I'm not talking out of hand here with this community, someone who struggles with anxiety really significantly, having had a couple of good months and feeling enormously anxious about having had a couple of good months because she didn't know why. Right? It's a minefield, you know. But what about the solid structure of certainty? What about that other storyline I was talking about? Well, it turns out that certainty, as an idea or a feature of a mythology, has taken a beating both outside of and inside of religion. And I'm not saying no one believes that story anymore. Many, many people do. But the prevailing culture has moved on, and it's left us with this damning critique of the myth of modernity, including conventional Christianity, which leaves us with the rather pressing question of now what? Well, I'm going to do something that's unusual for me. I'm going to talk about the next little bit in steps. Like step one, step two, step three. Anyone? When was the last time? Anyway, I'm just not tilted that way. It feels way too prescriptive. But let's just see what happens. So, addressing ourselves to a question as broad as now what? How do you respond to that? Well, arguably, I'm going to say that step one is to try to put words and ideas around what we're afraid of, which is what I've been trying to do for the last 20 minutes or so. Partly because Bauman's definition of something with only vague contours that is still acutely present everywhere is helpful and also almost utterly unaddressable. So talking about, thinking about, writing about, being in dialogue about, reflecting about what it is that we are afraid of can help us realize, among other things, that this might not be the thing we need to panic about. The vague thing might not be the thing. One of the reasons this is important is because it can help to provide at least a semblance of a contour for what we're afraid of. This is not about banishing fear, this step. This is about giving it a more particular shape. And that's important because we do not, as human beings, have limitless capacity for the vague. We get quite distressed in the face of pervasive lack of definition. This is one of the things that can help us figure out where to look for our next step as an individual. And that can help us collect around us people whose next step is like ours. It can help us to begin to act rather than react. This is one of the places where the lie behind a lot of our isolationist choices needs to get a real good kick in the shins. We're inclined as human beings, when we're afraid, when we're in this state, to retreat from community. I think it's a very natural, we could explain it evolutionarily. If we reveal a weakness, we become vulnerable. That's deeply rooted in us as human beings. It also completely and utterly does not work when it comes to the address of fear. Short story. I hadn't planned to tell this, but it distressed me in a way that I didn't expect it to. So back to Davis's this piece called Inertia. So before their show last night, we were just hanging out with Davis and part of the cast of that show at the Beer Gardens at Old Market Square. And a cast member from a previous year's show, I don't know how many of you had a chance to see Drowning Girls at the Fringe last year, but a member from that cast came because the producer of Davis's show is the person who directed Drowning Girls, blah, blah, blah. It's like it's a community, right? Anyway, this is a person who's had many of the experiences that Inertia is meant to address. This is somebody who's had those kind of relational and seduction games played on and with them by people in authority as part of Fringe, which is what the play addresses itself to. And she just came in, sat down, said she'd seen the play, blah, 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 so we're talking about all this theater stuff. And then I just asked her a couple of questions, and she started telling stories. And she started telling stories that included over there, like two tables away, this happened. And just over there, that happened. And just over, and my God, I nobody needs a blubbering father of somebody that they know in the theater world sitting at their table at the beer tent. And so I pulled up shy of that, but it took some work. Because my heart was in shambles. I'm like, you walked in here how many times and all you wanted was to sit down and have a beer as a human being, and you had to wade through that shit to get your beer? in the environment of an institution that exists to make this space for freedom. Come on. Why was I telling you that story? Because in the course of this person telling her story, I just kept questioning her. I said, you can wave me off anytime, but I'm going to keep going after this until you do, basically. So, and she was game, so we just went for it. So I was like, you know, what do you do? Like, what are you doing? Like, what's the other side of this look like? You know, I made sure that I'd said something that helped her know that this ache, I heard her. But then, like, now what? Right? And she started talking about what her process is for gathering around her the people who've had similar experiences, who understand the dilemma, so that they can resist it together, so they can do something positive about it. Awesome. When I talk about giving a contour to our fears being important, this is one of the reasons why it's important, is because we do better together with difficult things like this. And when we retreat from relationship because we feel like nobody else could possibly be having this experience, it's understandable and usually not helpful. The other direction is a lot harder, I know. It's also better. Step one, put some words and ideas around this that helps us to define what it is that we're struggling with, and that helps us to find the places where we can act instead of react. And for those of us whose spiritual explorations tend to keep us swimming in the current of Christianity, in particular, step two might be to acknowledge that what I've been calling conventional Christianity this morning took the shape that it has in conjunction with modernity. In other words, the two myths that I was talking about this morning grew up to have a particular shape together. And this is important. To put it into different words, the shape of the first mythology I talked about, the origins of human morality, that mythology is not a system of belief made by God and delivered whole to all of humanity as the last word on human-divine interaction. It's a system of beliefs that we made, and it is subject to all the same sorts of limitations and pitfalls as anything else we made, including the myth of modernity. That means it needs to evolve to survive. And because systems of belief tend to share characteristics with their surrounding culture, this is just not hard to see in history, we can sometimes get a glimpse of how our beliefs need to evolve by looking at what the cultural thinkers are observing about what's going on in the cultural in general. So let's say that that's step three. Looking at what the cultural thinkers are observing in the culture around us and letting that inform our understanding of how our own precious mythologies might need to evolve to survive. So for the remaining few minutes, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to go back through those steps and put them into more particular context. This is not meant to be directive. Your journey is going to be your journey. My hope is that what it'll illustrate is what it might look like to move forward rather than staying stuck in fear, particularly in fear about how shifts in what we believe or how we live out our faith might impact us. Okay? So step one, what are we afraid of? Bowen suggests that although dangers have always existed, in our age we live in a state of continuous uncertainty, which makes us afraid. So let's say, for today's conversation at least, that we're afraid of uncertainty. Also a pretty fundamental human experience. And let's allow that, we're afraid of uncertainty, to give some shape to our fears and our conversation about fear. Step two. Our belief systems are formed in no small part by their surrounding culture, and they change in ways that reflect that fact. So, we don't need to freak out when we feel dissonance about what we've been taught. We don't need to freak out when we find ourselves saying, either internally or externally, I don't think I believe thing X anymore. In fact, it's entirely reasonable that those sorts of feelings and thoughts are signs of spiritual health. They just might be pointing toward the fact that we have a dynamic and lively spirituality rather than one that's dormant or static, basically a way of saying you still have a spiritual pulse. And as a result, you've been growing and changing, and as a result of growing and changing, you might need a different shape of garment. You might need a different story. Step three. What can we observe about changes in our surrounding culture that might inform our imagination about our own systems of belief? One last idea from Bauman. By the way, This guy is one thinker in a world of thinkers. He has fans and critics. He has adherents and detractors. There's nothing uniquely laudable about Bauman's perspective. I'm using it today to illustrate a process, not because I think this is a person who's got the next set of answers. Interesting thinker. That's it. In any case, here's the idea. Bauman would suggest that there are two crucial values for human life. He would go so far as to say, without these values, human life is not an entertainable thought. So one of those values is security, which he simply defines as feeling safe. The other value is freedom, the ability to self-assert, to do what you really want to do. Security without freedom is slavery. Security without freedom is slavery. I'll take care of all your needs, you have to do what I want. That's security without freedom. That's slavery. Freedom without security, there we go, is chaos. If we can do whatever we want, but there's nothing against which we can measure this or against which it can rub to give us a sense of the boundaries of our freedom, then we have chaos. Bauman, who's somebody, because he's Polish, who grew up under two different dictators, is quick to say that he believes that we have a lot more freedom than our grandparents had, but we have traded for that freedom. And what we have traded for it is security. And that results in us feeling lost and not knowing what to do. Which is what makes us uniquely vulnerable to leaders that will say to us, give me the power and I will take responsibility for your future. You just hand it over to me. I'll take care of you. You give me the power, I'll take care of your future. That would be security without freedom. Okay? By the way, this is not just true for political leaders. This is true for every kind of leaders, including religious leaders. So if what we're trying to do is find a currently workable blend of freedom and security, and if we need to work toward finding that in all parts of our society, including our religious practice, what might that look like? What might it look like to experience both the freedom to believe what we want to or are drawn toward believing, and to do so in ways or environments in which we feel safe? What might that look like? Well, that's what we're going to address ourselves to more the next time that we're together, is that question. Not next Sunday, but August the 13th at Pantages. And just a reminder, if this stuff keeps rumbling around inside of you when you leave here, the presence of the divine doesn't depend on our ideas about it. By definition, that which we use God language for does not depend on us for its existence. We can't cause it, and we can't make it go away, which is a very important aspect of our not being afraid. What faith invites us to is to, if we're certain about something, to start there. That which we call God does not depend on me. And then we have a pending question immediately that has to do with the nature of that. Is that good? Is God good? So then we can wrestle with that, and so on. But now our fears and our uncertainty begin to have contours already. Our wrestling begins to have a shape. And to have a shape, to have actual questions that we are wrestling with, is not to be lost in the swamp of uncertainty. It is not to know everything. It's not to live under the hubris of the myth of modernity, of inevitable progress, inevitable human perfectibility, and so on and so forth. But it's also not to live under the weight of a discernibly historical beginning for a mythology that says, you have no hope in this. We'll take that one on quite directly in a couple of weeks. Different space. So, as we go from here and we wrestle with these things and we wrestle with their implications and what the shape of them might be in our world and how do we act that out and so on and so forth, I want to leave us with the words of the Apostle Paul, who, speaking to a community that found itself also in a state of change and not quite sure what to make of its own spirituality, he offered this prayer. I think it's a good one for all of us. May you know the presence of the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our troubles so that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we ourselves receive from God. Peace to you all.